Hello, angels. It is me, Willow, and I am here to record the fourth installment of Madeline L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time. We are, as I just stated, on chapter four. However, I want to address something before I do. I'm on a new microphone. If I sound fucking fantastic, please, like, tip your hat to my partner. He has decided that the best way to support me is to enable me. So, here we are. I don't deserve him. I'm spoiled, care about him a lot, all that stuff. So I hope this sounds fantastic, because any test I've done sounds great. I've turned off every fan in this room so that you don't get any background noise. You're sitting really cute on top of my laptop because the microphone's so small and adorable. Anyway, I'm done doing that now. Anyway, as I said, this is the fourth chapter, so if you have not heard the first three, I strongly suggest you do that before you get any further into this. If you want to hear them, they are pinned in the media channel on my Discord server, and they are also on the Safe for Work audio index that is pinned to my Reddit profile. I have to add the third chapter to that, so I'm sorry. I will try and do that when I upload this one. They're also on my Twitter if you feel brave enough to scroll through a bunch of shit posts, which you shouldn't feel that brave, because I feel bad that there's a lot there. Anyway, I am settled in bed. I have something to drink. I'm super cozy. I have a candle lit. I'm ready to go. Everything is set on Do Not Disturb. I want to crack my neck, but I'm afraid you might actually hear it. So I'm not going to do that. I have water because I'm a hydrated bitch. I've never been super mindful about hydration, and I'm working on that. So without further ado, chapter four of A Wrinkle in Time, titled The Black Thing. The trees were lashed into a violent frenzy. Meg screamed and clutched at Calvin, and Mrs. Witch's authoritative voice called out, "Quiet, child!" Did a shadow fall across the moon, or did the moon simply go out, extinguished as abruptly and completely as a candle? There was still the sound of leaves, a terrified, terrifying rushing. All the light was gone. Darkness was complete. Suddenly the wind was gone, and all sound. Meg felt that Calvin was being torn from her. When she reached for him, her fingers touched nothing. She screamed out, "Charles!" And whether it was to help him or for him to help her, she didn't know. The word was flung back down her throat, and she choked on it. She was completely alone. She had lost the protection of Calvin's hand. Charles was nowhere either to save or to turn to. She was alone in a fragment of nothingness. No light, no sound, no feeling. Where was her body? She tried to move in her panic, but there was nothing to move. Just as light and sound had vanished, she was gone too. The corporeal Meg was simply not any longer. Then she felt her limbs again. Her legs and arms were tingling faintly as though they had been asleep. She blinked her eyes rapidly, but though she found herself back, nothing else was. It was not as simple as darkness or absence of light. Darkness has a tangible quality. It can be moved through and felt. In darkness, you can bark your shins. The world of things still exists around you. She was lost in a horrifying void. It was the same way with the silence. This was more than silence. A deaf person can feel vibrations. There was nothing to feel. Suddenly, she was aware of her heart beating rapidly in the cage of her ribs. Had it stopped before? What had made it start again? The tingling in her legs and arms grew stronger, and suddenly she felt movement. This movement, she felt, must be the turning of the earth, rotating on its axis, traveling its elliptic course around the sun. And this feeling of moving with the earth was somewhat like a feeling of being in the ocean. Out in the ocean beyond its rising and falling of the breakers, lying on the moving water, pulsing gently with the swells, and feeling the gentle, inexorable tug of the moon. I'm asleep. I am dreaming, she thought. I'm having a nightmare. I want to wake up. Let me wake up. Well, Charles Wallace's voice said, that was quite a trip. I do think you might have warned us. Light began to pulse and quiver. Meg blinked and shoved shakily at her glasses, and there was Charles Wallace, standing indignantly in front of her with his hands on his hips. Meg, he shouted. Calvin, where are you? She saw Charles. She heard him, but she could not go to him. She could not shove through the strange, trembling light to meet him. Calvin's voice came as though it were pushing through the cloud. Well, just give me time, will you? I'm older than you are. Meg gasped. It wasn't that Calvin wasn't there, and then that he was. It wasn't that part of him came first, and then the rest of him followed, like a hand, and then an arm, an eye, and then a nose. It was sort of shimmering, looking at Calvin through water, through smoke, through fire. And then there he was, solid and reassuring. Meg, Charles Wallace's voice came. Meg, Calvin, where's Meg? I'm right here, she tried to say, but her voice seemed to be caught in its source. Meg, Calvin cried, and he turned around, looking about wildly. Mrs. Witch, you haven't left Meg behind, have you? Charles Wallace shouted. If you've hurt Meg, any of you, Calvin started, but suddenly Meg felt a violent push and a shattering, as though she had been thrust through a glass wall. Oh, there you are, Charles Wallace said, and rushed over to hug her. But where am I? Meg asked breathlessly, relieved to hear that her voice was now coming out of her in more or less a normal way. She looked around rather wildly, and they were standing in a sunlit field, and the air about them was moving with the delicious fragrance that comes only on the rarest of spring days, when the sun's touch is gentle and the apple blossoms are just beginning to unfold. She pushed her glasses up on her nose to reassure herself that what she was seeing was real. They had left the silver glint of a biting autumn evening, and now around them everything was golden with light. The grasses of the field were a tender new green, and scattered about were tiny multicolored flowers. Meg turned slowly to face a mountain reaching so high into the sky that its peak was lost in a crown of puffy white clouds. From the trees at the base of the mountain came a sudden singing of birds. There was an air of such ineffable peace and joy all around her that her heart's wild thumping slowed. When shall we three meet again, in thunder, lightning, or in rain? Came Mrs. Hu's voice. Suddenly the three of them were there. Mrs. Wetsit with her pink stole askew, Mrs. Hu with her spectacles gleaming, and Mrs. Witch still a little more than a shimmer. Delicate multicolored butterflies were fluttering around them, as though in a greeting. Mrs. Wetsit and Mrs. Hu began to giggle, and they giggled until it seemed that, whatever their private joke was, they would fall down with the wild fun of it. The shimmer seemed to be laughing, too. It became vaguely darker and more solid, and then there appeared a figure in a black robe and a black peaked hat, beady eyes, a beaked nose, and long gray hair. One bony claw clutched a broomstick. Well, just to keep you girls happy, the strange voice said, and Mrs. Wetsit and Mrs. Hu fell into each other's arms in gales of laughter. If you ladies have had your fun, I think you should tell Calvin and Meg a little bit more about all this, Charles Wallace said coldly. You scared Meg half out of her wits, whisking her off this way without any warning. Horace, to action little, less to words inclined, Mrs. Hu intoned. Mrs. Hu, I wish you'd stop quoting, Charles Wallace sounded very annoyed. Mrs. Wetsit adjusts her soul, but she finds it so difficult to verbalize, Charles dear. It helps her if she can quote instead of working out the words on her own. And we mustn't lose our sense of humor, Mrs. Witch said. The only way to cope with something deadly serious is to try and treat it a little lightly. But that's going to be hard for Meg, Mrs. Wetsit said. It's going to be hard for her to realize that we are serious. What about me? Calvin asked. The life of your father isn't at stake, Mrs. Wetsit told him. What about Charles Wallace, then? Mrs. Wetsit, unoiled, door-hinged voice, was warm with affection and pride. Charles Wallace knows. Charles Wallace knows that it's far more than just the life of his father. Charles Wallace knows what's at stake. But remember, Mrs. Hu said. This is something literally in a language that is not using the English alphabet. Euripides? Nothing is hopeless. We must hope for everything. Where are we now and how did we get here? Calvin asked. Uriel, the third planet of the star Malak and the spiral nebula of Messier 101. This I'm supposed to believe? Calvin asked indignantly. As you like, Mrs. Witch said coldly. For some reason, Meg felt that Mrs. Witch, despite her looks and ephemeral broomstick, was someone in whom one could put complete trust. It doesn't seem any more peculiar than anything else that's happened. Well then, someone just tell me how we got here. Calvin's voice was still angry, and his freckles seemed to stand out on his face. Even traveling at the speed of light, it would take us years and years to get here. We don't travel at the speed of anything, Mrs. Wetzet explained earnestly. We tesser. Or you might say we wrinkle. Clear as mud, Calvin said. Tesser, Meg thought. Could that have anything to do with Mother's Tesseract? She was about to ask when Mrs. Witch started to speak, and one did not interrupt when Mrs. Witch was speaking. Mrs. Wetzet is young and naive. She keeps thinking she can explain things in words, Mrs. Who said. Says something in French. French, you know, the more the man knows, the less he talks. But she has to use words for Meg and Calvin, Charles reminded Mrs. Who. If you brought them along, they have a right to know what's going on. Meg went up to Mrs. Witch. The intensity of her question she had forgotten all about the Tesseract. Is my father here? Mrs. Witch shook her head. Not here, Meg. Let Mrs. Wetzet explain. She is young, and the language of words is easier for her than it is for Mrs. Who and me. We stopped here, Mrs. Wetzet explained, more or less to catch our breaths and to give you a chance to know what you're up against. But what about Father? Meg asked. Is he all right? For the moment, love, yes. He's one of the reasons we're here. But you see, he's only one. Well, where is he? Please take me to him. We can't. Not yet, Charles said. You have to be patient, Meg. But I'm not patient, Meg cried passionately. I've never been patient. Mrs. Who's glasses shone at her gently. If you want to help your father, then you must learn patience. This is what we must do. To sake one's life for the truth. That is what your father's doing, Mrs. Wetzet nodded. Her voice, like Mrs. Who's, was very serious, very solemn. Then she smiled her radiant smile. Now, why don't you three children wander around and Charles can explain things a little? You're perfectly safe on Uriel. That's why we stopped here to rest. But you aren't coming with us? Meg asked fearfully. There was silence for a moment. Then Mrs. Witch raised her authoritative hand. Show them, she said to Mrs. Wetzet. And something in her voice, Meg felt prickles of apprehension. Now? Mrs. Wetzet asked, her creaky voice raising to a squeak. Whatever it was Mrs. Wetzet wanted them to see, it was something that made Mrs. Witch wanted them to see, it was something that made Mrs. Wetzet very uncomfortable, too. Now? Mrs. Wetzet said. They may as well know now. Should I change? Mrs. Wetzet asked. Better. I hope it won't upset the children too much, Mrs. Wetzet murmured as she thought to herself. Should I change, too? Mrs. Wetzet asked. Oh, but I've had fun in these clothes, and I have to admit, Mrs. Wetzet's best at German. The work proves the craftsman. Shall I transform now, too? Mrs. Wetzet shook her head. Not yet. Not here. You may wait. Now don't be frightened, loves, Mrs. Wetzet said. Her plump little body began to shimmer, to quiver, to shift. The wild colors of her clothes became muted, whitened. The pudding bag shape stretched, lengthened, merged. And suddenly, before all of the children, was a creature more beautiful than any Meg had ever imagined, and the beauty lay in far more than the outward description. Outwardly, Mrs. Wetzet was surely no longer Mrs. Wetzet. She was a marble-white body with powerful flanks, something like a horse, but at the same time completely unlike a horse. For from the magnificent mottled back sprang a nobly formed torso, arms, and a head resembling a man's, but a man with perfection of dignity and virtue, and the exultation of joy, such as Meg had never seen before. No, she thought, it's not like a Greek centaur, not in the least. From the shoulders slowly a pair of wings unfolded, wings made of rainbows, of light upon water, of poetry. Calvin fell to his knees. No, Mrs. Wetzet said, though her voice was not Mrs. Wetzet's voice. Not to me, Calvin, never to me. Stand up. Carry them, Mrs. Witch commanded. With a gesture both delicate and strong, Mrs. Wetsett knelt to the front of the children, stretching her wings wide and holding them steady, but quivering. "On to my back now," the new voice said. The children took hesitant steps towards the beautiful creature. "But what do we call you now?" Calvin asked. "Oh, my dears," came the new voice, a rich voice with the warmth of a woodwind, the clarity of a trumpet, the mystery of an English horn. "You can't go on changing my name each time I metamorphose. Sure. And I've had such a pleasure being Mrs. Wetsett. I think you better keep that." She, he, it smiled at them, and the radiance of the smile was as tangible as a soft breeze, a directly warming as the rays of sun. "Come," Charles Wallace said as he clambered up. Meg and Calvin followed him, Meg sitting between the two boys. A tremor went through the great wings, and then Mrs. Wetsett lifted, and they were moving through the air. Meg soon found that there was no need to cling to Charles Wallace or Calvin. The great creature's flight was serenely smooth. The boys were eagerly looking around the landscape. "Look," Charles Wallace pointed, "the mountains are so tall that you can't see where they end." Meg looked upward, and indeed the mountains seemed to reach to infinity. They left the fertile fields and flew across the great plateau of granite-like rock shaped into enormous monoliths. These had definite rhythmic form, and they were not statues. They were like nothing Meg had ever seen, and she wondered if they had been made by wind and weather, by the formation of this earth, or if they were creations of beings like the one on which she rode. They left the great granite plain and flew over a garden even more beautiful than anything in a dream. In it were gathered many creatures like the one Mrs. Wetsett had become, some lying among the flowers, some swimming in a broad crystal river that flowed through the garden, some flying in what Meg was sure to be some kind of dance, moving in and out above the trees. They were making music that came not only from their throats, but from the movement of their great wings as well. "What are they singing?" Meg asked excitedly. Mrs. Wetsett shook her beautiful head. "It won't go into your words. I can't possibly transfer it to your words. Are you getting any of it, Charles?" Charles Wallace sat very still on the broad back, on his face an intently listening look, the look he had when he delved into Meg or his mother. "A little, just very little, but I think I could get more in time." "Yes, you could learn it, Charles, but there isn't time. We can only stay here long enough to rest up and make a few preparations." Meg hardly listened to her. "I want to know what they're saying. I want to know what it means." "Try, Charles," Mrs. Wetsett urged. "Try to translate. You can let yourself go now. You don't have to hold back." "But I can't," Charles Wallace cried in an anguished voice. "I don't know enough. Not yet." "Then try to work with me. I'll see if I can verbalize it a little for them." Charles Wallace got his look of probing, of listening. "I know that look," Meg thought suddenly. "Now I think I know what it means, because I've had it myself, sometimes doing math with Father, when a problem is just about to become clear." Mrs. Wetsett seeming to be listening to Charles' thoughts. "Well, yes, that's an idea. I can try. Too bad you don't really know it, so you can't give me the direct, Charles. It's so much more work this way." "Don't be lazy," Charles said. Mrs. Wetsett did not take offense. She explained. "Oh, it's my favorite kind of work, Charles. That's why they chose me to go along, even though I'm so much younger. It's my one real talent. But it takes tremendous amount of energy, and we're going to need every ounce of energy for what's ahead of us. But I'll try. For Calvin and Meg, I'll try." She was silent. The great wings almost stopped moving. Only a delicate stirring seemed to keep them aloft. "Listen, then," Mrs. Wetsett said. The resonant voice rose, and the words seemed to be all around them so that Meg felt that she could almost reach out and touch them. "Sing unto the Lord a new song, and his praise from the earth, from the end of earth, ye that go down to the sea, and all that is therein, the isles, and the inhabitants thereof. Let the wilderness and the cities thereof lift their voice. Let the inhabitants of the rock sing. Let them shout from the top of the mountains. Let them give glory unto the Lord." I need water. I'm sorry. Throughout her entire body, Meg felt a pulse of joy such as that she had never known before. Calvin's hand reached out. He did not clasp her hand around his. He moved his fingers so that they were barely touching hers, but joy flew through them, back and forth between them, around them, and about them and inside them. But when Mrs. Wetzet sighed, it seemed completely incomprehensible that through this bliss could come the faintest whisper of doubt. "We must go now, children." Mrs. Wetzet's voice was deep with sadness, and Meg could not understand. Raising her head, Mrs. Wetzet gave the call that seemed to be a command to one of the other creatures flying above the trees nearest them. It raised its head to listen, and then flew off and picked up three flowers from a tree growing near the river and brought it over. "Each of you take one," Mrs. Wetzet said. "I'll tell you how to use them later." As Meg took her flowers, she realized that she was... Oh, it was not a single blossom, but hundreds of tiny flowerets forming into a kind of hollow bell. "Where are we going?" Calvin asked. "Up." The wings moved steadily, swiftly. The garden was left behind in the stretch of granite, the mighty shapes, and then Mrs. Wetzet was flying upward, climbing steadily up, up. Below them, the trees of the mountain dwindled, became sparse, and were replaced by bushes, and then small, dry grasses, and then the vegetation ceased entirely. And there were only rocks, points and peaks of rock, sharp and dangerous. "Hold on tight," Mrs. Wetzet said. "Don't slip." Meg felt Calvin's arm circle around her waist in a secure hold. Still, they moved upward. Now they were in the clouds. They could see nothing but drifting whiteness, and the moisture clung to them and condensed in icy droplets. As Meg shivered, Calvin's grip tightened. In front of her, Charles Wallace sat quietly. Once he turned just long enough to give her a swift glance of tenderness and concern. But Meg felt as each moment passed he was growing farther and farther away, and he was becoming less and less her adored baby brother, and more one with whatever kind of being Mrs. Wetzet, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Witch actually were. Abruptly, they burst out of the clouds into a shaft of light. Below them, there were still rocks. Above them, the rocks continued to reach up into the sky. But now, though it seemed miles upwards, Meg could see where the mountain at last came to an end. Mrs. Wetzet continued to climb, her wings straining a little. Meg felt her heart racing. A cold sweat had begun to gather on her face. Her lips felt as though they were turning blue. She began to gasp. "All right, children, use your flowers now," Mrs. Wetzet said. "The atmosphere will continue to get thinner from now on. Hold the flowers up to your face and breathe through them, and they will give you enough oxygen. It won't be as much as you're used to, but it will still be enough." Meg had almost forgotten the flowers and was grateful to realize that she was still clasping them, and that she hadn't let them fall from her fingers. She pressed her face into the blossoms and breathed deeply. Calvin still held her with one arm, but he too held the flower to his face. Charles Wallace moved his hand with the flowers slowly, almost as though he were in a dream. Mrs. Wetzet's wings strained against the thinness of the atmosphere. The summit was only a little ways above them, and then they were there. Mrs. Wetzet came to a rest on the small plateau of smooth, silvery rock. There were ahead of them a great white disk. "One of Uriel's moons," Mrs. Wetzet told them, her mighty voice faintly breathless. "Oh, it's beautiful," Meg cried. "It's beautiful." The silver light from the enormous moon poured over them, blending with the golden quality of day, flowing over the children, over Mrs. Wetzet, over the mountain peak. "Now we will turn around," Mrs. Wetzet said, at the quality of her voice, Meg was afraid again. But when they turned, she saw nothing. Ahead of them was thin, clear blue sky. Below them, the rocks thrusting out of the shifting sea of white clouds. "Now we'll wait," Mrs. Wetzet said, "for sunset and moonset." Almost as she spoke, the light began to deepen and darken. "I want to watch the moonset," Charles Wallace said. "No, child, don't turn around, any of you. Face outward, towards the dark. What I have to show you will be more visible then. Look ahead, straight ahead, as far as you can possibly look." Meg's eyes ached from the strain of looking and seeing nothing. Then, above the clouds which encircled the mountain, she seemed to see a shadow, a faint thing of darkness so far off that she was scarcely sure she was really seeing it. Charles Wallace said, "What's that?" "That sort of shadow out there," Calvin gestured. "What is it? I don't like it." "Watch," Mrs. Wetzet commanded. It was a shadow, nothing but a shadow. It was not even as tangible as a cloud. Was it cast by something? Or was it a thing itself? The sky darkened, the gold left the light, and they were surrounded by blue. Blue deepening until where there had been nothing but an evening sky, there was now a faint pulse of star, and then another, and then another, and then another. There were more stars than Meg had ever seen before. The atmosphere is so thin here, Mrs. Watts had said, as though to answer her unasked question, that it does not obscure your vision as it would at home. Now look. Look straight ahead. Meg looked. The dark shadow was still there. It had not lessened or dispersed with the coming of night, and where the shadow was, the stars were not visible. What could be there but a shadow that was so terrible that she knew that there had never been before or ever would be again anything that would chill her with a fear that was beyond shuddering, beyond crying or screaming, beyond the possibility of comfort. Meg's hand holding the blossom slowly dropped, but it seemed as though a knife were gashing through her lungs. She gasped. There was no air to breathe. Darkness glazed her eyes and mind, but as she started to fall into unconsciousness, her head dropped down into the flowers, which she was still clutching, and as she inhaled the fragrance of their purity, her mind and body revived, and she sat up again. The shadow was still there, dark and dreadful. Calvin had her hand strongly in his, but she felt neither strength nor reassurance in his touch. Beside her, a tremor went through Charles Wallace, but he sat very still. He shouldn't be seeing this, Meg thought. This is far too much for a little boy, no matter how different and extraordinary a little boy. Calvin turned, rejecting the dark thing that blotted the light of stars. Make it go away, Mrs. Watson, he whispered. Make it go away, it's evil. Slowly the great creature turned around so that the shadow was behind them, so that they saw only stars unobscured, the soft throb of the starlight on the mountains, the descending circle of the great moon swiftly slipping over the horizons. Then, without a word from Mrs. Watson, they were traveling downward, down, down. When they reached the corona of clouds, Mrs. Watson said, "You can breathe without the flowers now, my children." Silence again. Not a word. It was through the shadow that somehow... It was though the shadow had somehow reached out with its dark power and touched them so that they were incapable of speech. When they got back to the flowery field, bathed now in starlight and moonlight from an other, smaller, yellower rising moon, a little of the tenseness went out of their bodies, and they realized that the body of the beautiful creature on which they rode had been just as rigid as theirs. With a graceful gesture, it dropped to the ground and folded its great wings. Charles Wallace was the first to slide off. "Mrs. Who? Mrs. Which?" he called out, and there was an immediate quivering in the air. Mrs. Who's familiar glasses gleamed at them. Mrs. Which appeared too, but as she had told the children, it was difficult for her to materialize completely, and though there were a robe and a peaked hat, Meg could look through to the mountain and stars. She slid off Mrs. Wetzet's back and walked, rather unsteadily after the long ride, over to Mrs. Which. "That dark thing we saw," she said. "Is that what my father is fighting?" That's chapter 4, which honestly was beautiful. So, I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope the quality of this was good. I'm going to listen to it back. I'm very excited. I love you all very much. Be kind to each other. Hydrate. And have a wonderful night.